grateful that he's here, and it's been awesome getting to see him again. It's been a long time, and I'd like to welcome Joe N. from Madison, Alabama.
We ain't going to no dance at 10 o'clock. My name's Joe, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. I was, man, I tell you, let me get all the formalities. First off, I want to say, you know, the committee, you guys are awesome. This is the first time I've had the opportunity to speak at a young people's conference, and man, I tell you what, you just blow the top off of everything I've ever done before. So, Chris and Georgia and Ron and Mike and Joe and everybody, if you've served on this, let's give them another hand because they really did. Now, I'm going to start off with a resentment because you've read for everybody else. So I'll read for myself.
You weren't around.
Well, I know it. I'm trying to get a little bit straight, you know. Go back over here. I'm going to read my favorite, not just one of my favorites, because I can't. It says here that when we became alcoholics, pressed by self-imposed crisis, we could not postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What is our choice to be? You know, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober. My sobriety date is March the 17th of 1987, by God's love and grace. I came to the program in about 1980. I don't know if you're alcoholic like me, but your years will run together. So I don't know if it was 81, 82, 83, somewhere in there, but they blended. So I'd come in, and what happened for me was that I got here, and I went into a, I'm from Las Cruces, New Mexico, and I went into a meeting. I'd just gotten out of treatment. I walked into a meeting, and there was this little, it was a little room, you know, just a little old AA house, and there was some couches, and there was this, you know, a couple of people, and sitting right here, there was this girl talking. I got there late, and this girl was talking, and man, this chick was a fruitcake, man. It's just like, I'm thinking, I'm listening to her, and she's just like, and I couldn't, it's like no two sentences matched, you know, it was like they were just, wow, man, from here to there, and I'm like, oh my God, what's she talking about? Then she passed and went to the next lady, and there was this red-headed woman, and she was talking about, oh, my kids, if they just do this and they just do that, and they did this and I did, and I'm looking at her thinking, man, right off the bat, I got this clue that I wasn't like these people. You know, I thought to myself, man, I'm not like these people. Sitting across the room in the corner from me, directly across the room with this guy in this big, puffy yellow chair. And they come around, and they've gone from that lady that was talking about her kids, and it went to another guy, and this guy gets up, and he didn't get up, but he starts talking. He said, my name's Ron, and I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, he says, you know, I know if you just don't drink and change a little, everything will get better. And I thought to myself, yeah, well, yeah, maybe if I just don't drink, you know, that's it. Because something deep down inside of me wanted to change. Something deep down inside of me didn't want to be what I had become. Now, there's this, another way I was thinking about what to read too, you know, and I was thinking about, you know, it says if a mere code of morals and better philosophies were sufficient to overcome drinking, many of us would have done it years ago. You know, I didn't like who I was. So it goes around, and this Ron passes, and it comes to this guy in this puffy yellow chair. And this guy is, I'm talking about a wino, man. I mean, his hair was just like, it was like, I mean, it was matted. It wasn't just like braided and stuff. I mean, it was matted, you know, and he had these glasses on that were so thick I couldn't even really believe he could see through them, you know, and he had black tape on them on one side. Black tape was holding it together. He had black tape right in the middle. Hey, my name's Bob, he says, and I'm an alcoholic. He said, I'm the last of the real hobos. I'm sober by God's grace. And I'm looking at this dude thinking to myself, you are an alcoholic, man, and I am not nothing like you. You see, there was something so much more different than me. And I looked at them, and I looked at these people, and I thought, man, you know, I don't have a drinking problem like you guys have. You come in here, you quit drinking, and things get better. He comes in here, he quits drinking, and he's not a hobo anymore. You know, and I'm like, You don't understand. You see, for me, my problems were much, much different. I had issues. I didn't have problems. I had a wife that was leaving. I had a mother that had kicked me out of the house. I had been driving on a revoked license for 4 years. I had all these other things, and it was never my doing. It was, this is an aside, I went to court one time. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm rather creative. And I remember I'd gone in there, and I'd taken one of these easels, just like this thing right here, and I took in this big cardboard, and I had these little cars on them. And I said, "You see, Your Honor," I walked into the court and I said, "You see, Your Honor, this is where he started following me. And then he followed me all around here and he drove in and then he followed me here and it took him 8 miles to stop me. 8 miles. I've clocked it. I've gone over it a number of times. And I don't understand if I were guilty, why didn't he stop me in the first mile?" The judge just looked at me, sat up there just like at a podium like this, looking straight down at me. He said, "Were you drinking and driving?" But it's his fault because he followed me. And my whole life has been a rationalization about everybody else. It's been a rationalization about how he followed me for 8 miles. And my God, he should have stopped me in the first place. Then I would have been an alcoholic, you see. And my whole life has been like that. Well, I used to think when I first started, when I got sober and I started doing these little talks and stuff, it used to be very, well, it probably still is. Anything I say, if I say I did like 50, it was probably more like 14. You know, if I said I did this, it was probably, but I've gotten better, so it's down to 50 from the 150 it used to be. But, so when I talk about things, you know, one of the things that I like that I remember and I reflect on is my family. Because when I first got here, if you grew up like I grew up, if you grew up in the neighborhood I grew up in, if you grew up with the people for parents that I had to deal with, if you had the brothers, there was always this everything, you know. And so what happened was, is I grew up in southern New Mexico, and, you know, being Mexican, man, we had parties. We don't just have a little, you know, get together and come on over for Joe's birthday. We're going to have a cake. It's a tardeada, man. I mean, we're going to kill the pig. Our damn party's on Saturday, and we're starting on Wednesday afternoon, you know? And they come in, and what would happen was that all my family would come on over. It's Joe's birthday, man. We're going to kill a pig, you know? So they come on over, and it's Wednesday afternoon, and they're starting the fire already. And what would happen is that they'd have this keg over there, and they'd tap that keg, and they'd pour that beer, and they'd pass it around. Now, I'm this little kid, and I would look around, and I have this perception problem, and what would happen to me is that I would look at these people, and I would be so just overwhelmed, blown away. That's my uncle, man. That's my Uncle Bob, you know. And there's my Uncle Jim, and oh man, look. And I'm just kind of like watching everybody, you know. And they're passing that beer around, and a little while later, somebody breaks the bottle open. Say, "Hey, take a swig of this, man." And what I noticed would happen is it seemed like the party always seemed to escalate. You know, the men would be out there by the fire, and they'd be talking to the pig, and they'd be doing all this other stuff, and the women would be inside rolling up the tortillas for this big weekend and all this other stuff. And the next thing I know, our parties always seem to escalate. You know, the mood always got a little bit louder, a little bit, oh, man, yeah. And so Bob would tell Bill, "You should have seen that buck, man. I was sitting there right above him, and I was getting ready to shoot him. And just as I was getting ready to shoot him, my gun jammed. I didn't know what to do. It was the biggest thing I'd ever seen." "Well, what'd you do, man?" So I'm thinking, I'm sitting here listening to Bob and Johnny and all these other guys. "Well, what'd I do, man? I jumped on into my staff and did that. You should see the fish I got, man." It's man. And so everybody's just getting like so wound up by this. And I'm like inside this excited. It's my birthday, man. I can't believe it. You know? And then all of a sudden, right out of the middle of the party, something would happen, and Leo would yell over to Billy, "Billy, man, where's my lawnmower, dude?" And then this party would get real quiet.
And everybody's watching, Johnny, Bobby, all these guys watching all this, man. What's Billy going to do? Because they already know that Billy broke the lawnmower, you know? I broke it, man. What do you mean you broke it? And the next thing you know, they're pulling Billy and Leo out of the fire. And the big, big party that's supposed to happen on Saturday never happened. And something would happen to me, and I would go to school the next day, and I would think to myself, man, because you see, I was confused. How could my heroes also be the zeros in my life? How could I go from this to this? And for 1 second, I was the absolutely most just out of my skin little happy little kid to the most embarrassed, most ashamed individual you'd ever seen in your whole life. My whole life vacillates between those two feelings. My whole life has vacillated from this idea that if you knew what I was like inside, what would you think of me? And that happened way before I ever took the first drink. You see, what I have is a disease. I have a disease called alcoholism. And this alcoholism, to me, manifests itself in one way. And that one way to me is that I don't see things right. I used to think it was because I drank alcohol. But now what I come to understand, oh, there's that damn phone. Right in the middle of there's Johnny. So what happened for me is that I had this perception problem. And what happened? What happens, and I've seen it over and over and over again. Now, I would watch my mom and dad get in fights. My dad would come home at 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'd hear this yelling, you know, and it would get real crazy, and I'd be thinking to myself, no, stop, stop. And I'd hold on, and I'd hear them fighting. I'd hear the punches fly, and I'd think to myself, I'm never going to be like that. I'm never, ever going to be like that. I won't let myself be like that. And from as young as I can remember, I hated the idea of alcohol. Now, one side of me hated the idea of alcohol. That was the thing that brought the fires about. But the other side said, well, what about the party? What about the excitement? What about the joy? And somewhere along the line, what happened to me was, out in the middle of a cotton field in southern New Mexico, about 10, 11 years old, me and my cousin stole a bunch of my grandpa's beer. We're sitting out there in this cotton field, and I remember we popped the top off of these malt liquor tall boys. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, man, I love the way Bob talked about it this morning. You know, I was like, oh, man, that smell. You know, I looked at it, and I thought, oh, man. So I pinched my nose, you know, and I sat back and I poured that thing back. Now all of a sudden it didn't smell too bad, you know? And I was like, what? So I poured it back and I poured the next one back and I poured the next one back and I poured the next one back. I have no idea. I have no concept of what this social idea about drinking is. I drink for effect. When it was shown to me what the big book says and the doctor's opinion about men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Well, you see, for me, what happened was, is that somewhere along the line, now I don't know, you know, I've got this idea that there's this giant baby machine, and there's this little, it's got this little foot thing, and that little, they step on that little stopper, they pop them out, you know, and all these little babies, there comes Billy, there comes Johnny, there comes Susie, boom, 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 and here comes all these little babies, you know, and every little baby, they take the baby, they sit him in his little bassinet, and then they take the book, and they tuck his little book right up next to him, and every little baby gets his book, and that's the book of life. He knows what he's supposed to be doing, who he's supposed to be doing it with, and how he's supposed to be doing it. And Joe comes along, pops him out. Where's the book, man? It was like, I don't know, just send that one on without one, you know? And that's how I have felt my whole life. I have felt like my whole life, you all, everybody out there got the book of life. And I missed out. Something happened to me. And because you knew who you were supposed to be with, how you were supposed to do it, who you were going to do it with, and where it was supposed to happen at, everything in your life went fine. But you see, I'm not like you. And if you knew I didn't have the book, what would you think of me? And that day in the cotton field, my book came in a can of malt liquor. And what happened to me was, is the effect produced by alcohol was so elusive that I could not, after a time, differentiate true from the false. And my perception was distorted. My perception was distorted in a way that said, this is true. This is real. This makes me whole. you complete me. You know, man, it was like, for whatever reason, man, it made me everybody. It made me, it brought me life. Now, you don't become an everyday alcoholic at 11 years old, you know, but what happened for me was that a seed was planted, and I knew somehow or another, somewhere way back there, that effect I would chase forever. I love that passage. I absolutely love that passage in there because it talks about that they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. And to them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And me, you see, what happened for me was is that this normal life of mine was that I got shorted the book, you know who you're supposed to be with, how you're supposed to be doing it, who you're supposed to be doing it with, and my got screwed. And that's the truth, and that's all there is to it. And so I start judging everybody outside of myself for not getting the book. I start blaming everybody for the rest of my life about not getting the book. Well, this little problem of mine, I kind of like to think of it this way. You see, I perceive with my eyes that everybody got the book and they function normally. This is normal right here. Perfectly happy, joyous, and free. With the right husband, got the right kids, got the perfect job, got all this stuff, and you function normally. But you see, I'm down here. I'm not like you. I'm different. And if you knew how different I was, what would you think of me? So in order for me to perceive myself at the same place that you're at, I got to perform at this level. And one of the things that I did is I played football. Growing up, I played football in junior high all the way on up, and when I played football in high school, I was Mr. Football! Yeah, man, I come down, it was like I could see myself. I have these dreams still, you know, of me walking down the hall. Jacket, you know, all the little pins, all this stuff. Yeah, get out of the way. And girls running up into my arms. Oh, Joe, whoa! You see, because what that meant for me was is that if I performed at this level, you would at least see me at a level that was like you, and you wouldn't think of me or know me of what I was really like. So I could perform up here. Offense, defense, kickoff, kickoff return, get in there and throw, and I'd get in there and I'd give them everything I got. Now, you know, a lot of years later, I've had four surgeries on my knees, my hands still creak, my back's all screwed up. I don't think I was a really good football player as much as I was an idiot, you know? Because I am willing to go to any length to win you over, to win your approval over, to win some fashion, some way to get you to like me. And so I played this football, and what it did is it got me through high school. I got through high school, and I graduated, and one day a friend of mine came over, and we ended up at a frat party. We went into that frat party, and it was a big, huge, huge yard, and there was a semi-truck parked in the back, and the semi-truck had beer stickers sticking out all over it. And we walked in there, and, I don't really know what heaven looks like, but damn, it had to look like this, man. Over here, there were people getting high over there, and girl, it was southern New Mexico in August, and girls had shortest shorts on, the tightest shirts on. I'm walking in there, and I can hear them talking. They got 100 cans of beer, man, 100 cans, and everybody's running back there, and they're just filling up their cups, man. I'm like, God, I found you! Oh, man! And I went back in there, and I filled those cups up, and then I said, sign me up. Man, where do I sign? Where's the book? Tell me what I need to do. I'll join the fraternity now. And I did, man. I signed up for that frat that night. A couple of weeks later, now, I don't know if you're alcoholic like me, but there's some very scary words that live in my life. Those words are, Joe, we need to talk. Shit, they found out. See, I always got this idea that now you know. And John, the president of fraternity, calls me over and says, man, we need to talk. I said, yeah, dude. What's up, man? No, dude. You're XYZ, man. We're brothers. And I'm, yeah, man. What's up? Well, dude, you know, it's like, we want to keep in the fraternity and stuff, but you're going to have to register for school, man. It's like, you can't be in the fraternity and not be registered for school. Oh, that. Oh, yeah. No, don't worry about that, man.
Yeah, but school's been on for a couple weeks now, man. Like, oh, yeah, now I'll get it, man. So I took a couple classes. History of rock and roll, you know, and art appreciation, government. Needless to say, I got kicked out. I mean, I academic probation, then I got kicked out the next semester, and being the achiever, being the Mr. Go-To guy, you know, I was working at this little restaurant. See, in the early days, it was a steakhouse. That's a like a restaurant that had fried hamburger. They called the steak burger or something like that. But anyway, so I was working at this restaurant, and they promoted me to key employee or to assistant manager, and they moved me to Clovis, New Mexico. And I got out there, and to make a long story short, I walked in, I saw the manager, I talked to the manager. Manager was talking to this young lady. He introduced me to that young lady. I said, hi, my name is Joe. She told me her name. I said, would you like to get married? She said, sure. I said, let's have some kids. All right. You know, and then maybe later on I'll beat the hell out of you and you'll divorce me. And she said, oh, yeah, that sounds like a plan. Yeah. I don't know if that's how it happened, but that's what happened. You know, and if that wasn't enough, I got divorced, I got married, I got divorced, I went to my divorce date, I walked in there, I sat in front of that judge one more time with a million alibis, with a million excuses, with a million reasons to why we were going to get together. What happened there was, and here's the greatest miracle of all, I ended up in treatment for alcoholism. I ended up in a treatment center in El Paso because I was depressed. She can't leave me! Me? You know, how could you, the perfect husband, because you see, I perform. Well, I also performed with a lot of other ladies, but she didn't really have to, you know, it's, and it, she couldn't understand. You know, well, you know, and so I ended up in treatment, and I went back to the divorce date, that we went to court, and she was 6 months pregnant. The judge asked me, he said, well, sir, do you have representation? I said, no, Your Honor, I don't. I've been to treatment. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm never, ever, never going to drink again. You see, Your Honor, I'm here because it's a technicality. I'm going to sign the paperwork, and me and her, probably, you know, a week or two, we'll get back together. It's God's will. So he said, well, you know, she's petitioned for a relinquishment of parental rights. Oh, yeah. Another technicality. Don't worry about it. You know, me and my son, I see us playing baseball already. Well, we were married 1 year and 3 hours. That day what happened to coincide with our anniversary, and I went to the truck. I brought her these big old roses, and she looked at me and she said, you don't get it, man. You will never see me again, nor will you ever lay eyes on this child. And she's kept that promise to this day. I have a son I have never met. I don't know where he is or where they are to this day. Some now 20 years later. So I left and I thought, but I went to AA. And I went to that meeting, you know, and there was Bob and there was all of them. And see, they were alcoholics. And if they just stopped drinking, their lives get better. But I stopped drinking. I went to treatment and I just got divorced. They just went to treat. They're talking about how they just don't drink anymore and change a little and their lives are better and everything's going well for them, but I've got a son I'll never see for the rest of my life, or who knows when. And so along the way, somewhere out there by Roswell, and that's why they see UFOs out there, there's a bar right in the middle of the highway, you know? I mean, just right in the middle between Clovis and Roswell, 50 miles out of nowhere, a bar. So I pulled in one more time and made my life the only normal one. Because, you see, I couldn't go on one more second in my head living like that. Well, I was sitting in a bar one day, and this little girl runs up to me and says, come on, you're Mexican, let's dance. I said, hell, let's have kids. Let me beat the hell out of you, and you divorce me too. And she said, all right. You know, and that's exactly what happened. Because that's all, with everything was exactly like the first one. You see, what happened was is that one day I woke up, and this little girl, just a little tiny thing, my brother comes, she wakes up and she's got this big black eye, you know, and her face is all beat up, and my brother's coming over and he's talking to me. He said, damn, Joe, what's going on with you, man? I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, do you know what you did last night? I was like, no, what? And he starts to tell me, and there she is, and she doesn't want nothing to do with me, and I'd become everything I despised, everything I swore with everything that I was, that I would never, ever become, I had become exactly that. Now, I already knew something was wrong with me, and I knew something didn't fit. But something this time was validated, because you see, for before, I could always hide it on the outside. I could hide it to you, and I could go home, and I could sit and be by myself, and I could sit, and I could drink it away, and I could drink it away, and it would feel okay. Well, that girl has my daughter, and I don't know where they are today. I ended up going back to Las Cruces one more time, and I was sitting there, and I don't know, it just had gotten to the point where I'd go to these meetings, and something would happen, you know. I'd come back to these meetings, I'd go into treatment, I'd get out, and I'd try to make a good stab at it, and if I could only, and there was always this thing, and this thing was, is that if I could only get her back, if I could just pay the judge off, if I could just get my license, if my boss would stay off my butt, if this would happen, if that would happen, there was always all these external circumstances that if I could just get them all lined up, everything would be okay. You see, you guys, you and Alcoholics Anonymous, don't have the problem I have. You don't drink, and those things take care of themselves. I don't drink, and those things get worse. And I'm not like you. You see, I'm not like that hobo sitting in the corner. And I'd go out, and I'd come back in, and I'd come back in, and there'd be sitting Bob in the corner.
Hey, my name's Bob, and I'm the last of the real hobos, you know, sober by the grace of God.
On Saturday mornings, we would have these donuts. We'd take donuts and Danish and all this stuff, and he'd go over there, and he'd take a napkin, and he'd put this napkin, like, to make this little pillow. And he would go back to the donuts, and he would just stack them up, man. I mean, he'd just fill this thing up with donuts and Danish and stuff. And then he would take his little coffee, and he would go back to the corner, and he would sit there, and he would stuff these donuts in his mouth, and his cheeks would be this full, man. He'd be pouring coffee, and it'd be pouring all over him, and I'm thinking to myself, I am not an alcoholic like that. That's an alcoholic, man. That's not my problem. And I'd look at that guy, and I'd say to myself, and I'd justify within myself, that that's what an alcoholic really looked like. And I don't look like that. I'm 22 years old. I've just got a couple life issues going on. Well, I'd go out, I'd come back. I'd go out, and this time it'll be different. And me and number two were trying to work things out, and we'd get a little bit better, and it just kept falling apart. Everything kept falling apart. One day I'm sitting in the treatment center one more time, and I called her up. I said, I'm never going to hurt you again. I'm never going to do this, but I've been in treatment now 3 times. And I am not going to do this anymore. I've been to AA, and I know what AA is all about. So could you come pick me up? And she said, well, yeah, sure. And I said, hey, wait, before you hang up. And she said, yeah. I said, bring that pot with you, okay? She said, well, yeah, all right. And I was stoned, man, driving out the driveway one more time, wondering, and then thinking to myself, you know, Christmas trees. That's what I'll do. I'll cut Christmas trees down. If I cut Christmas trees, I'll buy them for this much. I'll sell them for this much. And then I'll pay the judge off and I'll get this. And always, 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 you see, my favorite, absolutely my most favorite sentence in the Big Book is that sentence that says, is he not the victim of the delusion that he can wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world if only he manages well? Because I've got this idea, this delusion, that if I could only get everything square out there, I'll be square in here. I'll go from here to here, and I won't have to live up to this anymore. And for some reason or another, I've got this idea that I like to use this example. It's like, you know, if you lead a donkey with a carrot, you tie this stick, and it's got this string and a carrot on the end of it, and you put that out in front of the donkey, you could get him to go anywhere you want, because he'll keep on chasing that carrot, you know? He just keeps on he'll just keep on going for it. Well, I'm the same way as that donkey, except with one difference. The only difference between me and the donkey is that the donkey can't carry his own stick. You see, what I do is I get this stick, and I get it just close enough, and then I'll move it again. Because I can't, because no matter what, this insatiable idea for me to manage well can never be satisfied. Well, I end up in treatment again, and I come back out, and there's Bob. Damn, dude, don't you ever leave? You know, I'm thinking, and there he is, And what I noticed was that something was significantly different. He still stunk. His hair was still matted. He still ate the donut, but he had new glasses on. And I looked and I thought to myself, wow, how could that dude get new glasses? You know, and it seems so trivial, you know? It's like, but man, there was something, there was a mark of hope in him. Some way or another, what had happened to me was that, you know, when I first came in, I'd come in these suits and I had this nice car and all this stuff, and gradually I kept on deteriorating. I'd come in and it'd be a couple of days since I'd had a bath or a shower, you know, and there'd always be one thing, if I could just get this done, if I could get that done, and it just kept getting worse. Well, I went over to my mom's one day. And my mom said to me, she said, Joe, I love you more than anything. I love you more than anything in the world. You're my firstborn child, and you are my precious little baby. She said, but I can't watch you kill yourself, and I can't let your brothers and sisters watch what's going on to you either. And she said, you don't come back here anymore. And I was like, how could you do that to me? You know, I was already pissed as it was. I grew up, here I'd become this. I'd beaten my wife. I got these kids. I don't know where they're at. My family, you know, hey, you can always rely on family, but I couldn't even do that anymore. They had said, don't come here anymore. And so it was just one more reason for me to blame somebody else, to look outside of myself and say, this is what's wrong. Well, I was living in the back of my car in this 1971 Ford banana yellow LTD station wagon, man. Crashed in on all three sides. You know, you had to get in through the passenger side, didn't just to drive it, much less get in the back. And I was, you know, I was just pretty much, I was running out of gas. My ex that at that time had gotten out of the, I'd gotten out of treatment on the day my daughter was born. I went straight to the hospital and I told her, I said, maybe me and you won't have anything to do with each other, but I am not going to not be a part of this girl's life. She saw I meant business, and I told her, you see, because now I'm sober. I'm never going to drink again. And so I had made this resolve because I had seen what alcohol had done to my life. I had seen how it had become such an effect on me. And I had seen, and I said, I got to stop this. I got to go hang out with Bob. I got to see Selma every day, and I'm just not going to drink. I get this minimum wage job, and I'm trying to be a little, you know, provide diapers and stuff, and man, everything's falling apart. One day, Christmas Eve of 1986, I'd been taking Anabuse since I got out of treatment in September. You know, you can always go the Anabuse sobriety route. I'm eating this Anabuse and going to these damn meetings, and somewhere in there, my higher power says, you know, you're not so bad when you smoke pot. Oh, really? She said, yeah. She said, but just when you drink, man. I said, oh, I'm not going to drink anymore, I promise. I'm done. So fire it up, baby. So we rolled another one, you know, and the next thing I know, it's Christmas Eve. I'm waiting there for Christmas. They're supposed to show up, and they don't show up. And I've not seen them again since that day. New Year's Eve, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking to myself, restless, irritable, and discontent doesn't begin to tell you what I felt like. I was screaming inside. Everything I hadn't drank since September and everything inside of me was falling apart, man. I hate my job. I hate my family. I hate everything that's going on. And then I'm just like, just my skin is itching, you know? And I'm thinking, you know, yeah, I've been taking this Anabuse since September, but I haven't taken one since yesterday. maybe. And I thought to myself, one drink on Anabuse won't hurt me. So I went to Circle K. I got one of those big 64-ounce Thirst Busters that they had at that time. And this is the honest-to-God truth. I mean, I say this every time I speak, and it still freaks me out because you don't understand. I don't know if you, well, not that you don't understand, if you... you'd probably do. How rational this was to me. One drink on Anabuse surely can't hurt me. So I took that Thirst Buster glass, I filled it with a fifth of gin, I splashed it with tonic. I splashed a little bit of lime on top of that and said to myself, surely this one drink can't hurt. I took that gin, I poured it back, man, and there it was, just like the day in that cotton field. One more time, man, I could feel the warmth. I could feel the sense of ease and comfort that comes by taking that drink. The drink we see others taking with impunity, and man, I'm telling you what. But then all of a sudden, something happened. This wasn't like a normal drunk. It was kind of like the prelude to mushrooms, you know? It was like, damn. You know, the hair feeling, you know? Man, I'm feeling this stuff. I'm like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. What have I done, man? All of a sudden, I'm feeling my heart. And I'm like, oh, shit, man. What happened, man? And I start getting these big red blotches all over my body, man, and my heart's jumping out of my chest. I'm thinking, oh, my God, oh, my God, I'm going to die, I'm going to die. I felt like at any minute my heart was totally going to explode. And then it felt like Mark McGwire took a baseball bat and punched me right in the stomach, and what I say is that at that point there was fluid coming from every single orifice on my body, and I knew to tell you there were none left out. Of all the things I've done in my crazy, crazy life, as crazy as this sounds, that is one of the things I'm more grateful for than anything else. As crazy as it sounds. Because you see, nobody poured that gin down my throat. Nobody. As sick as I knew, after four treatment centers, I knew it would make me sick. They had told us every time about what abuse and alcohol do together. They had told us that it could potentially kill me. Honey, the pain needed to be stopped. And for me, that pain is solved by one way, and one way only. And that is for me to pour alcohol on top of it again. And I poured it on top, and the pain started. Anyway, so I made a strong resolution. I did. I said, I will never do that again. Ever. Never, ever. And I stopped taking antabuse that day, man. Now, you see, I believe that there are two surrenders in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe there are two surrenders in recovery. The Big Book says that we believe that there is no middle-of-the-road solution, that we come to a point where life was becoming impossible, that we're at the jumping-off place. Another place calls it the jumping-off place. And it says, but we have but two alternatives. One of these alternatives is to go to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, or the other is to seek spiritual help. And that's a choice I have. You see, I'm at this fork, and I don't know what to do. And for me, I was at that surrender place. And I could either surrender to alcohol, or I could surrender to recovery. But you see, recovery to me was so far away, because I wasn't like Bob, and I wasn't like Ron, and I wasn't like Jesse, and I wasn't like all those people that I'd seen. They stopped drinking, and their life gets better. I stopped drinking, and my life gets worse. And you don't understand. I'm different. And so I sat there, I waited for the antabuse to go away, you know, and I hit it. And I surrendered to drinking like I'd never had before. Get me a bottle of tequila and get me some, you know, this is another thing, but I won't even go there. Yeah. You know, now Corona seems to be the big deal. I could go down there and buy like a bucket of it for $2. You know, and I'm like, so I'd go down there and I get this bucket and I get this bottle, and if I could come up with $15 every day, then man, my day was made. Enough money to put in the big old cruiser, get down there, come on back and get drunk again. Go to a pool table, try to hustle somebody off of a couple of bucks and try to make it one more night. Over and over and over again. And one night, getting sick and tired of being sick and tired, no more money, I went over to my grandma and grandpa's house. You know, you can always count on grandma. I went into grandma's and I said, Grandma, I haven't taken a shower in I don't know how long. My clothes haven't been washed. You know, can I come in just for a little while? Can I just rest? And grandma, you know how they are. Oh, mijo, come on in, you know. And she took me in, man. And my grandpa was sitting there. You know, my grandpa's one of my greatest of all the heroes. And he didn't even have a knife to stab the deer. You know, he choked him. And he's sitting there, and I go in, and I'm sitting there, you know, and I'm going to go take a shower. And he says, "You know, man, if you were doing that, and if you just did this, man, you just ought to be a man." And I'm like, "Oh, Grandpa, not you too, man. Oh, please tell me I don't have to go through this with you now. Because you see, the noise in my head is already so loud, I can't shut it up." I got up, he got up, we brushed each other, something happened. He said, "Man, you want a part of me?" Of course, he'd been drinking all evening. And, "You want a part of me, man?" I'm like, "Grandpa, I'm not going to fight you, man." One thing I've always been blessed with is this country strength, man. I don't know why, I don't know where it comes from. I've just been a strong dude. And I went outside with my grandpa and I told him, "I'm not going to fight you, I'm just going to leave." We pushed, he pushed, my grandma came out, he pushed her to the ground, and I went off. And I almost killed my grandpa. He laid there on this little gravel road, and I broke his ribs. I kicked his eyes were just completely shut, filled with blood. His lips were hanging off of his mouth, and I just kept on kicking. You see, you don't, it wasn't about, and I'd kick him again, I'd kick him again. It wasn't about beating my grandpa up. It was about just stop inside. Where is it going to stop? My whole life was driven by fear. My whole life was driven by anger. My whole life was driven by this idea that when am I ever going to be okay? And I can't get okay. And there was the next victim in front of me, and I just kicked the hell out of him. So I went, and I got in that car. I went with another friend of mine, and we hooked up on this deal. I stole some money from him and ended up in a motel room. And I'm sitting there drinking, smoking, doing everything I possibly can to get out of myself, and nothing seems to work. You will come to a point that it's the jumping off place. You will come to a point where alcohol even turns on you. You will come to a point where, yes, your body will be drunk, but sobriety stares you in the eyes. When everything inside of you says, "I can't go another second," I was flat out of gas. I called my mom and I said, "Mom, this is it. I'm done. I hate myself so much. I hate what I've done to you, and God, look at Grandpa over there, you know." And I said, "Tonight, that's it. You'll never see me again." And I gone back. I took one of my dad's guns. I went back to this motel room, and I was going to put it in my mouth. And what happened to me was, it's like an Alice in Wonderland kind of movie. And it was just like this out-of-body experience. And this lady, this treatment center woman, was right there in front of me, and it was like her head was floating around the room, you know? Jails, institutions, and death. Ha-ha! Jails, institutions, and death. I was like, shit, man. It was right there in front of me. Jails, institutions, death. That's where people like you end up, Joe. Jails, institutions, death. Jails, institutions, death. And what I came to realize is that they weren't talking about the jail. They weren't talking about getting locked up and incarcerated. They were talking about the jail I lived in here. They weren't talking about the institutions like the treatment centers and the halfway houses and all this other stuff that I'd already been through. They were talking about the institution here that blamed all of you for my pathetic life. They weren't talking about the institutions that were all that was going on out here. They were talking about everything inside of me that had a belief that said, if I only, then I'd be better. And they weren't talking about the death of me getting wrapped around some oak tree on the way home tonight. They weren't talking about getting shot with some dude's old lady. They were talking about the death I was living one day at a time. I was a walking dead man. And somehow or another, beyond what I can comprehend or give you any rational idea or understanding of, I threw my hands in the air and I said, "God, if you're real, whoever you are, please help me, because I can't go one more second like this." And I've been clean and sober since that day by the loving grace of God. What happened was, the very next morning, I end up in treatment. I went to treatment and I heard some really awesome things. Bikers, man. Bikers are the dude, man. Shit. Damn those dudes, man. The leather, you know, the chicks, man. The cigarette hanging from their mouth. If I could only be a biker, you know, then I'd be happy. If I could only, we'd gone to this meeting, and I was in treatment in Albuquerque, and we'd gone out in a Wednesday night meeting, and it was the Chapter 5 group. And they were sitting there, they had this meeting, we pulled up from this treatment center, we get out, and all the bikes, man, like probably 150 bikes laid out in front of that place, just all lined up. Awesome. All the dudes hugging each other, man. Yeah, hey, sober, dude, yeah, me too. Yeah. All leathered out and stuff. And we went in, and Big Josh was talking that night. And Big Josh gets up there, and this guy was this big, man. He was probably about this big, but he was a big dude. And he was sitting up there, and he talked about living in fear. Not you, Josh. I'm sitting here listening to this guy saying, how could you be afraid? And he talked about growing and making amends, about the people that he had hurt in his life, and about how Alcoholics Anonymous had changed his living, how he no longer lived in fear, and how he still rode with pride, and how he was a part of a fellowship that was greater than the Hells Angels he rode with before. And I listened to this guy, and I thought, wow. Went to another meeting the next day, and there was this other guy talking. He was talking about getting laid off from one job and walking across the street and getting a better job, doing the same thing, but he'd never noticed. And the guy that he went and got the better job with was in the program. He said, man, and I like the weekends off so we could spend time with our families. And I've been working all these, like, 80, 90 hours a week. And I'm listening to these people, and man, I'm thinking to myself, wow, maybe there's something to this deal. And I got home back to Las Cruces, and I walked back into that meeting, and God dang it, guess who's sitting in the corner? You know, there's Bob.
My name's Bob. I'm alcoholic, sober. Sober by the grace of God. I'm the last of the real hobos.
Yeah, you are a hobo, man. And I'd sit there, and but there was something different now. He had a haircut. He had new clothes on. He didn't stink anymore. You know, I was looking at him, and he talked a lot more clearly. I was like, wow. That day, I walked in. I got out of treatment. I walked into that club. And there was Ken C. standing behind the counter, and I asked Ken to be my sponsor. Ken said, Joe, he said, no. He said, dude, I've been watching you for 5 years, man, in and out. It's always everybody else. It's your wife. It's your mom. Nah, that's a pleasure somebody else could have. And I looked at him in the eyes, and I said, Ken, I'll do anything. Anything you tell me, I will do it, man. I don't care what it is. I can't go on like this anymore. He looked at me and reluctantly said, all right, man, but if you don't do everything I tell you, you call me with the name of your new sponsor. I said, I'll do whatever. He said, okay. He said, this is what we're going to do. He said, the first thing I want you to do is I want you to go to meetings and don't drink in between. Oh, yeah, I can do that. Yeah, don't drink in between any meetings, though. I mean, none, you know, like, yeah, okay. And then he said, and the next thing I want you to know is that he said, I'm going to sponsor you by the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And we're going to work the steps like they're in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, anything more would be my ego. Anything else would be somebody else's ego. He said, what we use in AA is the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Anything else doesn't count. So throw away your... And so if, you know, and now I say this, and I say this rather arrogantly, if you have a sponsor who doesn't use this book, you don't have a sponsor. You know, and because this is the program. He then opened this page up to me, and he opened it up, and he showed me the circle and triangle, and he said, you see, each one of these things represent a spoke in a tire. He said, it's like this one right here. It says service, and the other one says unity, and the bottom says recovery. He says, take one of those spokes out, and every time that tire comes to that side, it's going to be flat. If you're not involved in the service of Alcoholics Anonymous, then when you get down the road and you start hitting that flat, that's what it is. Your service is gone. He says, and then if you get going down the road and you're really active in the service, but you're not active in the fellowship, he said, you're going to get flat. He said, and most of all, most of the time, when you run into a problem in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's because you left the bottom rung out, your recovery. That you're responsible for. He said, you see, our responsibility is to be here for the next guy who comes in, and all you've ever been here for is you. He said, when you get the idea that it's about them and not you, your life is going to change. I said, yes, sir. Anyway, he started working me through the steps. That was on a Sunday. The next night, Monday night, I went to the Monday night men's SAG meeting. I walked into that meeting, and I was sitting there, and I was like third or fourth in line. It was this big circle, you know, and the topic that night was hitting bottom. Gentlemen came to me, and it was like, gentlemen, kick back, listen to what hitting bottom is. I'm 25 years old. And I've lost two wives, and I've got kids, I don't know where they're at. And this little Mexican dude from across the room gets up and he says, "Shut up, little boy! Shut up!" And he starts walking up to me, man. He gets, and I'm sitting there, and he reaches up in his eye. He pops his glass eye out of his head, and he starts shaking his eyeball in my face. I'm sitting there looking at him. And I'm thinking to myself, you see this? He says, "I think I left it in Houston or something, man." He said, "Look at my fingers. I don't even know where they're at." He says, 28 years I spent in Skid Row. 28 years. And you come in here and your little wife, and you come in here with this, and you come in here with that. You know nothing of hitting bottom. And I sat and I looked at that dude, man, and it was like I could actually feel myself taking cotton, big wads of cotton, out of my ears and shoving it in my mouth and said, "Yes, sir, man." That was Roger, and Roger became one of my other sponsors. He became one of my dearest friends. They walked me through these steps, and Tim showed me about being powerless. And I'm going to try to blaze through this as fast as I can, but I cannot go wrong without doing this. He talked about powerlessness. He said, "You see, Joe, your whole life, you've been trying to manage the outside to make the inside feel better. But it's not about the outside. It's about being powerless. You see, what do you think about this powerlessness?" I said, "Well, man, when I drink it..." He said, "Yeah, you got that one down." He said, "But the problem is the unmanageability. And the biggest mistake I've seen people make, and I've made this mistake myself for years and years and years, is that I turn the first step into two steps. It is not two steps. It is one step joined by a hyphen. A hyphen does not separate. It joins. My life is unmanageable. And I had not come to understand that my life was unmanageable." And he said, "You see, you think your life is unmanageable because you can't pay your bills. Because if you only got this right and you got that right..." He had me look up life in the dictionary. And one of the definitions of life in the dictionary, believe it or not, says the emotional, physical, and spiritual makeup of a human being. And he said that your emotional, physical, and spiritual makeup is what's unmanageable. And you keep trying to fix and arrange the outside so that your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being will be okay. But you see, the big book says that when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. He said, "You got this all backwards." He said, "You're powerless, joined, and your life is unmanageable." And I was freaking out, man. I was like, wow. There was another guy, and Ken helped me through the second step as well, and we talked about this insanity, but Don was this other dude. And Don was this little, he was from Houston, as a matter of fact. Little Texan, about this big, skinny little Vietnam vet, 4 tours in Vietnam. He was a tunnel rat, you know, and all this. And this guy terrified the hell out of me. Because I knew, even as big as I am, this guy just, you know, reaching my eyeball to pull it apart, you know, whatever. I just knew it. And we were talking one day, and he said to me, he said, "Joe, who do you believe God is?" And I was like, I don't know. And so he took a piece of paper, he took this paper, laid it up like that, drew a line down the middle of it, wrote at the top of one side, "God is." And then on the other side he wrote, "God is not." He told me, "Write what you think God is not." He said, I don't want to abandon all your ideas about what you learned growing up as a Catholic and what you've done in this church and all this other stuff. Write what you think God is. You see, to me, people talk about the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and the miracle of Bill and Bob. And granted, I don't discount that any at all. But to me, one of the single greatest gifts Alcoholics Anonymous ever had was when Abby Thatcher told Bill Wilson, "Bill, why don't you choose your own conception of God?" You see, because what I'd come in here with was all these preconceived ideas about what that priest wanted me to think God was, about what I thought my grandma wanted me to believe God was, about what I thought they thought, "I think what you think what I..." It's confusing, right? So how in the world do you pray to that God? How do you have a personal relationship with something like that? And I took this paper and I wrote, "God is not." And I went down, I had this big old list. On the other side, I wrote, "God is," and I put "unconditional love." And I wrote "unconditional love," and that's all I put. Don took the piece of paper, he ripped it in half, wadded it up, threw it away, handed me the other side, and said, "Welcome to your higher power." Wow. No, dude, no, not that easy, man. No, yeah, it's that easy. So, like, no matter what I've ever done, God unconditionally loves me? If that's what you think he is. Huh. Oh, man, I was like, I felt like this little kid, like, it was, oh, no, man, no. Yeah. And making a decision wasn't very difficult anymore. Where I had a trouble in making a decision was that I thought I had to become a holy roller. I thought I had to go from a screaming, womanizing, drunken, maniac, crazy man, you know, to a sign-toting, you know, la 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 la. And I'm thinking, how do I go from this to that, man? And that's what I thought you were asking of me, and it's not. What it says in the third step is that we ask you to make a decision. And making a decision is very, very simple. I used to think, and one of the best things I ever heard was, you know, three frogs sit in the log, one decides to jump, how many are on the log? Three. Until he follows it up with action, right? Until he actually jumps. Well, it's just like that book. I can trust, but I'm trying to work the third step. I'm really, really trying, and I'm just having so much trouble. And no, you're not trying. It's either you do or you don't. You follow it up with action, and the action is to pick up the book and follow it up with a decision that says, and the book says, crucial and vital step, unless at once followed by strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things, blah, 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 we may not overcome drinking. Okay. I'm speeding up. I got through these steps. I got through my fourth step. Ken said, you have 7 days. 7 days, I told him. I can't do this fourth step in 7 days. He said, what's the name of your new sponsor? All right, dude, I'll do it, man. He said, I want you to be thinking about who you're going to do your fifth step with. And I told him, okay. And I said, I already know that. He said, who? And I said, Roger. Oh, that'd be good. So I got with I did my fourth step, and I went and I sat with Roger. And Roger, the Skid Row wino, man. He lives in this little apartment. We're sitting there. He said, okay, what are we going to do? He said, what we're going to do is we're going to do the fifth step. And he's got this big cheap tablet and a Husky pencil, you know, and I'm sitting there, okay. He says, you see right here, the root of all our trouble, the root right here, it says in the book right here, the root, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root. He says, and you're a selfish little boy, ego, 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 that's your ego. So I said, okay, go ahead and start. And so I started with these resentments, and I did this. And now what had happened was is that I think he and Ken kind of conspired. I'm sure they were thinking about me all the time and how I had to work this step. And then the first column, it had the resentments, and the next column, it had the cause, and then it affects mine. And the fourth column was left blank. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm done with it because I've done the first three. So I get with Roger, and Roger says, okay, now were you at fault? Where am I at fault? Oh, yeah. You see right here, it says that we now look at it from an entirely different angle. We saw what part we play. What were we dishonest? Self-seeking, selfish, self-centered, da-da-da-da. Well, Roger, didn't you hear me? I just told you what he did to me. Who am I at fault? I'm like, you're obviously not listening. You're not on my side, you know? And he's like, no, no. He says, I understand. He said, maybe he was wrong. He said, when did it happen? I said, well, when I was 5 or 6. And so what happened now? He said, that happened then. I said, yeah. He says, well, were you at fault? I said, where am I at fault? I don't know. And we sat, and he says, you were 5. You're 25 now. Yeah. You've been carrying it around for 20 years, and you have no fault? Oh, wow. And you've been using that. You've been using that to justify your pathetic existence, you see. You've been using that for an excuse to everybody else about how things have been bad to you, how life has been so bad over something that happened 20 years ago. You continue to use that to hurt other people, and you are not at fault? Wow. So were you at fault? Selfishness and self-centeredness. I said, man, that's right. You're selfish, selfish little boy. Ego, that's your ego. And then he wrote on his big sheet tablet. He wrote on his big sheet tablet, I-G-O, that's your ego. And I said, Roger, I don't think that's how you spell it, man. He said, I don't care. He said, no, that's your ego, selfishness, that's in it. Man, one right after the other. Boom, boom, boom. Ego, 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 ego. That's your ego, that's your ego, that's your ego. Yourself is your self-centered, yourself, selfish little boy. And I'm like, boom, 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 man. And I'm like, damn, man, I thought you're supposed to feel good when you finish this step. He's like, no, don't you worry. He said, what did you learn? What did I learn, man? Yeah, I'm selfish, I'm self-centered. All I ever think about is me. I justify my whole life by everybody else's actions. Like, I've got all these excuses. He said, that's right, you're a selfish little boy. He said, you see, selfishness and self-centeredness is the root. He says, if you have a peach and you have a pecan, and you plant the pecan, what grows? Pecan? Yeah, that's good, that's good. I was like, yeah. He said, your tree is selfish and self-centered, and the fruit you bear is selfishness and self-centeredness. You bear that fruit, Joe. Do you believe, he said, that God could turn pecans into peaches? And I said, well, I would have to. He said, that's right. He's everything or he's nothing. Then you have to believe, Nuno, that he'll turn your fruit into selfless fruit. And I sat and I looked. And then Roger did something that's more miraculous than anything I've ever seen in my life. He got up and he walked over and he turned the lights off in this little tiny apartment. Then he walked back and boom, boom, boom. He kicked everything over. He's like, I said, Roger, what are you doing? He says, I can't see. It's dark. I said, I know, man. You only have one eye, Roger. He's like, I know. He says, I can't see. It's dark in here. He says, you see, I live in this darkness and I'm always in collision with something or somebody, even though my motives are good. He says, it's just like you, you and your ego. You see, your ego blinds you from the light, Joe. You live blinded by the darkness of your own thinking. You live blinded by the idea that everybody has done something to you. He says, and you've justified it by your drinking and by the things that they've done. But you never take a look at what part you play. And he walked back over to the light, and he hit the light switch back on. And it lit up the room. He said, you see, in the light, I can go anywhere I want. Then he walked back over to the light switch one more time, and he turned the light off. And then he just stood there. And he said, you see, the hardest thing in the world for an alcoholic to do is to do nothing at all. To be powerless and wait on the light. And the little bit of light that was coming in over the curtain lit up the whole room. Our eyes adjusted. He walked around the things he'd kicked all over the floor and turned the light switch on. He said, you see, it'll always lead you to the light. But you've been chasing in the dark. And I said, wow. So what did you learn? He said, I said that I'm selfish and self-centered and that I've been driven by my own ideas of what I think. He said, that's right. He said, but now listen to this. He said, the light's always been there, but you've been too busy in the dark. I said, man, I'm selfish and I'm self-centered. How do I ever get out of this? He said, oh, you don't you worry. He said, that's what the rest of the steps are for. And then he said, Joe, he said, no. You're God's perfect little baby. Perfect little child. He said, you see, God doesn't make trash. He never looked at you and found fault with you. He sees you as perfect. But you've been living in the dark, and your own darkness is the only thing that holds you away from everybody. And for the first time in my life, somebody took me from where I live down here and how I judged up here and said, Joe, you're no better, and you're no less. You're just one of God's perfect little babies. Man, I was like freaking out. He said, I finished with him, and I went on. I went to another meeting, and I went into, there was this other guy at another meeting in Allen C., another. The book says this, the book says that. All I know is. I said, damn, that guy used to get on my nerves, man. He said, the book says, if you're a drunk and you steal horses, you're a drunk horse thief. You come into Alcoholics Anonymous and you sober up, you're still a horse thief. You're just sober now until you take the horses back. You see, the eighth and the ninth step for me, I can't have freedom. I can't have financial peace until I give you your horse back. I can't have a relationship that has that is full and that is I can be a full part of when I've got a horse corral full of bad relationships. I can't be a part of, I can't be a loving son, and I can't be a good father when I have all these horses that don't belong to me. So I take those back, and I stand, what I like to think, naked on the parkway. One of God's perfect little babies, no better, no less, just one of. And I can stand here with you all and say to you, if you don't live in the light, if you still live in the dark, find you somebody to walk you through these steps, because these steps are that thing that takes away that idea of mine, that perception of mine that says I'm not good enough. And the steps fill me with a power greater than myself, and that power greater than myself enables me to live happily and usefully whole. What it's like now, real quickly. I've been married to the same beautiful woman for 14 years. I love her more now than I did the day I saw her the first time. I think, you know, she tells me, and I think she shows me, that she loves me the same. We met, she came into the program, and we've had a hell of a journey in this deal. Some of it good, some of it not so good. One of the big things that I've made this huge mistake about forever was that if I get sober, then everything gets perfect, and that's not true. When I get sober, I now have a solution to what I lived in the dark for before. You know, I went back to college, in and out, while I was still drinking. Took psychology 5 times. I took math 6 times. I graduated finally in 1997 with honors, 3.98 grade, a point average. Oh, I did that, I still. One day at a time. You know, today I own my own business. Yesterday morning I was having breakfast with my mom, and she gave me this big old hug and just told me she just loved me, you know? And it's like, wow, man. And I wish I could tell you that all is what makes it so great, but this is what makes it great for me. You see, when I had about 2 or 3 years sober, I went back to that Aaron Club. I walked in there, and there he was in the back corner, man, still sitting there.
My name's Bob, and I'm the last of the real hobos, alcoholic, sober by God's grace.
And he's got new glasses, and he's got all, he's dressed now, and, you know, today Bob has over 20 years sober. And I'm sitting there, and I listen to him in a meeting, and I'm looking, and I'm thinking to myself, God, how I judge that man. We went out front, and we were sitting, and we were at the bar at this little club, and we're sitting, and we're having a cup of coffee, and I told him, I said, Bob, you remember when you first got here? And he said,
Oh, yeah, I know. I used to sit in that yellow chair over there. I said, yeah. I said,
yeah, well, the grease spot's still on the wall, man.
Yeah, you know, I came in here and said, somebody bought me a hamburger. He said, they bought me a hamburger, and I just didn't know what to do. He says, it was the last train stop. I didn't have any more gas. He said, I didn't know where I was going. They bought me a hamburger and said, just keep coming back, Bob. So I kept coming back. As I come back, he says, I drink the coffee, and I just don't drink one day at a time. I said, Bob, where did you live, you know? He says, you know that bridge down there by the Rio Grande? I said, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I said, but the one down way there? Oh, yeah. He says, yeah. I used to walk over here. It's about 5 miles. I said, you walk back and forth? He said, every day. Just come to a meeting. He says, oh, man, I could hardly wait for Saturday, he said, because they had those donuts in the Danish. He said, sometimes I hadn't eaten all week long, and the only thing I had to eat was donuts. He said, just keep coming back one day at a time. He said, I just keep getting better. He says, oh man, I got me an apartment now. He said, you should see it. I said, well, how long did you stay under that bridge? He said, a year and about, just over a year, every day. I said, man. He said, I just kept coming back. He says, you know, I got this apartment. He says, oh, I just got a VCR the other day. He says, I can't keep the girls away. He says, they're all over.
I said, Bob, and he said, well, come on outside, let me show you something. And we went outside, and there was a 10-speed bicycle. And he said, there she is. That's a Betsy. And I was like, wow, man, that's beautiful. But he says, you don't ask for much. Keep a little oil on the chain, keep the hairs tired. He says, she'll take me anywhere I want to go. He said, but Joe, I got a problem. See, most people won't spend time with Bob. And he says, I got a problem. I said, well, what's that, Bob? He says, now they want to call me Bicycle Bob, and I'm a hobo. I said, but Bob, change is good, man. He says, yeah, I guess it is. And he hopped on that bike, and he rode on down the road, and I watched him drop off, and I thought to myself, God Almighty, I'll judge him. You see, he's just one of God's little babies. He's just one of God's little puppies. No better, no less. Just like you. If you don't believe you're just one of God's little puppies, hang on. Don't quit before the miracle happens. One day you're going to look in the mirror and you're going to see God's smiling face right looking back at you. But don't quit before the miracle happens. Don't drink one day at a time. Go to meetings. Get a sponsor. Find yourself in this book. Give freely of what you have. Abandon yourself. And you'll surely join us on the broad highway. Thank you for letting me share.